Hi, my name is Sam Blizzard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices on how they've coped during the global pandemic. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. Today we welcome Yuande Akinola, an award-winning engineer, innovator and speaker. She has worked on projects in the UK, Africa, the Middle East and East Asia. She's passionate about STEM education and has talked about it on TV, in schools and also now in her role as the visiting professor at the University of Westminster. In the 2020 New Year's Honours List, she was awarded an MBE for services to engineering, innovation and diversity in STEM. She grew up in Nigeria and now lives in Rugby with her young family. Yuande, welcome to Comms from the Shed.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's a huge honour to be here.
And it's lovely to have you too, Yuande. I'm going to kick off just by asking you what you've found is the biggest challenge that you've faced into during the last 12 months.
I was pretty up there with the miles, you know, train journeys, car journeys, you know, flights. And I thought I was enjoying it. I really liked the adrenaline. I liked the fact that, you know, I was always in a hurry in the mornings. You know, I was always running after a train, missing trains as well, having random conversations with people on the train, meeting up with friends after work or as I was kind of traveling through a train station or something. And then it all kind of went from like 100 to zero. You know, I'll be very honest with you. Like, there were times I cried just because I was, you know, I wanted to move around. I wanted to fly and I was stuck, like glued to this chair. I had to really overcome that. I realized that I needed to spend more time with my family. I realized how much I'd been missing out on with my daughter as well. So there was a little bit of self-realization and, you know, a little bit of guilt as well. Like, oh gosh, you've been such a terrible mom for the last like 3-4 years, right? And now you're stuck with this amazing, amazing person. And there's so much you might have missed out on if there wasn't a pandemic. Yeah. So that has been my year. I'm much more comfortable with myself right now.
We talked there about the last 12 months. You're still incredibly busy. You know, you're doing so many different things. Maybe I was going to suggest asking you about a day in the life. Could you kind of give us a brief overview of a week?
You know what? I'd always say, yeah, I guess I'm an engineer, right? And but people have always been right at the heart of my engineering, if that makes any sense. So I started off wanting to be able to design engineering solutions for people around me. Even when I was a kid and I kind of would spend hours building models of homes, right? It was always for the people around me or my immediate family. And so for pretty much all of my life, I've needed that interaction with people. I've grown up, you know, I've developed my career around finding context for my engineering. In the last, you know, 12 months or, you know, say in the last week, those elements of interaction with people, the element of engaging and speaking the engineering language for sustainability always finds its place in, you know, conversations with people, you know, in interviews, in, debates, in trying to inspire, I guess, the next generation. And I would say that is the heart of it, to be honest, right? Everything else is a bit of a spill-off, but it all comes from me needing to be able to express ideas or learn from people.
I know that you dialed into a call with the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, recently. Can you tell us how that came about and what it was that you were discussing?
So his office reached out because he had been running a series of conversations around the future of jobs. I mean, obviously, it's been an incredibly difficult year for so many people. And, you know, people have also used this time to reflect on their careers. You know, there's been, you know, a lot of, you know, career changes as well. People have lost jobs, unfortunately. And so he's been running these conversations to work out and really bring to the surface what new jobs, you know, people need to start tracking, especially as we aim for our net zero ambitions. Of course, I was glad to be having the conversation, especially, you know, with an incredible panel of innovators. You know, there are people who are responding to healthcare and ensuring that we are a bit more resilient the next time a pandemic comes around. And so I was definitely up for it, and especially with my perspective of sustainability and how we start to skill up a workforce to be able to think differently. And it was a great conversation. You know, the exchange of ideas was brilliant.
You've had quite a journey to get to the point that you're at now. And for those listening to this episode who don't know you well and don't know your story, you were born in Nigeria in the mid-80s. Is that right? I mean, can you just tell us what your memories are of your childhood and your sort of formative years? What was it like growing up in the part of Nigeria where you spent your sort of early years?
Yeah, so I was born in Nigeria in a town stroke city called Ibadan. Born to, obviously, my mom and dad, Vera and Jonathan. My mom was a lecturer as well, you know, for a few years at a university called University of Ile-Ife. And I would spend, you know, lots of time on campus. I was surrounded by, you know, incredible architecture. My dad was a civil servant at the time, and he had retired, but he had spent a lot of his earlier years serving. And he kind of progressed up to the ranks of permanent secretary and worked as a minister for transport, for works and housing. So I was pretty much, you know, born into this home where there was great achievement, but then there was a lot of creativity as well. My mom's an artist, and so, you know, she was always sketching out something or dropping us off at, you know, her tutor's house. And he was an incredible architect stroke artist as well. And so it was lots of fun. There was art, there was politics, there was, exploration, there was creativity. My dad unfortunately passed on when I was only 5. And so my mom, you know, very quickly, like pretty much, you know, quite suddenly became, you know, this single mom of 2. And she was very, 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 you know, clear in her mind that she wanted to give us, my sister and I, the very best in terms of education, in terms of an exposure to huge possibilities. And so I would literally grew up to be inspired by her because I saw her overcome huge challenges. I also saw the lack of engineering infrastructure in my immediate environment. And that is when the idea that I could, you know, be a part of the solution started to kind of grow and evolve. because I could use the materials that were around me. So I used to make lots of models out of my mom's paper to build what I would kind of imagine would be much nicer houses to live in for me and my family and my friends. And that, you know, encouragement to be creative then morphed into engineering. So engineering that would then, you know, help me design a water supply system or a transport system or, you know, a power supply system that was actually, you know, reliable. Happy childhood, definitely.
Is it fair to say, I mean, there are some parallels, aren't there, between the path your father took and your own, in the sense that he was also very academic, pursued his studies, you know, studying classics, Nigeria, but also actually coming to the UK to carry on his studies and his work. I mean, was it a conscious or an unconscious thing? Do you feel in some way that you've sort of followed his path, either consciously or otherwise?
Wow, do you know what? Nobody has ever asked me that question, but incredible question. Wow. You know what? My dad was such an incredible man. So even though he passed on when I was very young, I grew up being so aware and so conscious of the incredible things that he had done. You know, I'd meet people in the most remotest of places, and, you know, they would ask what my surname was, and 5 minutes into the conversation, they'd be like, you know what, he actually commissioned, you know, that road that connects, you know, one town to another. Or, you know, one day, you know, I bumped into him somewhere, I didn't have any money, and he, you know, he offered, you know, a loan and asked me then never to pay it back. So I grew up with that. So, you know, he was always with me, but he was always my standard as well, right? He was always, you know, I always felt I had to live up to the standard that he had set. And even when I went to, you know, when I was in senior secondary school, I can remember one of the first days in senior secondary school, I can remember the owner of the school coming up to me and saying, actually, you know what, your dad was a great man, so we wouldn't expect less, you know, from you. So there was a lot of pressure, but I feel it, you know, it was probably his way of just encouraging me and pushing me on to do, you know, and be the best that I could be from the other side. I'm really going to have to, like, you know, dig deep and think about that question again, because, you know, I think it's very possible, actually, you know, that I've been on this journey and crafted this journey and pushed myself to the limits in so many instances because of the standard I feel that he set for us. Well done, Sam.
The journalism impulse that never leaves you, Ioande. Now, if anyone listening hasn't had the chance to tune in, or they didn't have the chance, I should say, to tune in last week, Ioande gave her inaugural lecture at the University of Westminster, and it was titled Global Citizen Reporting for Duty. And it's well worth a watch and a listen. And I want to ask you about something that came out of that great presentation that you gave. You mentioned a figure from your childhood. I believe his name is Demas Nwoku. And you talked about the fact that the building that you grew up in, I hope I get this right, had an amphitheater in the garden.
That's correct, yes.
And just how this sparked a kind of child's imagination. And I was really kind of tickled by that. Can you sort of talk a little bit more, just to sort of expand on that particular thing, sort of bring it to life for people, what a childhood in Nigeria was like?
So Demas Nwoko was my mom's mentor, right? So she had been, I guess, trying to work out her place in the world of art. And I really need to ask her to find out how she actually met him. For anybody who doesn't know him, go check him out. DemasNwoko. He is, like, as I said, right, you know, the Le Corbusier of Africa. And so she spent a lot of time with him learning pottery techniques, you know, learning how to express art through texture, patterns, you name it. And she became quite close to his family. And so when my dad passed on and she obviously had to, you know, work full time, she had to drop us off somewhere after school. And so there were a lot of times when she would pick us up from school and drop us off at this incredible space that he had created. You know, for anybody listening, go check it out. You know, located on a gorgeous hill with a view of the ancient city of Ibadan. You know, you literally look out and there's this sea of brown corrugated, you know, iron sheets. And the backdrop is what looks like a two-story mud house, but actually it's a mixture of brick and mud and, you know, a representation of African art and sculpture. And we would just spend so much time in there. There was an amphitheater behind where that he had actually built for university students, literally a few miles away from the location. And so students could come, there'd be plays on. But the great thing was that we had it, you know, like every single day of the week, you know. And at the weekend sometimes, you know, it would literally, you know, accommodate 200, 300, 400 people maybe. With dance, culture, you know, drums, the works. And that for me was the kickstarter, right? If that's the right word. That for me was, you know, the vision that helped me think, okay, yes, there's that connection between engineering, art, and performance, right? And the fact that I could be in that space and enjoy it all at once, you know, I look back on those times and just think, oh my goodness, I was just incredibly lucky. I don't think we realized it then because it was just our play area. You know, it was just that place that we pretended to be, I don't know, like actors and actresses. But now I look back and I think, you know what, I got a lot of validation for the idea of engineering meeting art from that space.
And what a powerful idea that is. I think now the message for my own daughters is clear. I think I've landed the arts and the love of bohemian pursuits, but I can play this podcast to them. We can add the engineering into the mix. One of the accolades you received quite early in your career was Young Woman Engineer of the Year. And you impressed the judges at the time with your work and your thinking on water and sanitation in developing countries. I know also that yesterday was World Water Day, and I just wondered what your thoughts on the sort of challenges ahead now and also what the goals are for 2030.
The idea and the conversation about, you know, on water is just such a huge one. You know, like, just again, going back, everything seems to be kind of rooted in my childhood, but going back, right, you know, again, I saw the impact the lack of water had in my immediate environment, right? You know, even now still, right, there are parts of the world where you just know that, gosh, if people didn't have to walk many miles to be able to collect water, they'd be spending the valuable time doing much more interesting, stroke inspiring things. And so with the sustainable development goal, right, you know, it's just so extremely important that we weave it back into the idea of sustainability. Now, my journey into water you know, I mean, call it fate, call it, you know, destiny, but just pretty much happened because, you know, I got an internship with Thames Water in between my second and my third year. My professor at university was very much a water expert. You know, my third year project was in water. You know, I started my first job, you know, in water. And it's just a testament to the fact that, you know, for a resource that we use and as absolutely need, you know, in our day to day, we perhaps don't realize like all the work and all the effort that goes into, you know, the fact that we can have access to it. Now, what the judges were impressed by, you know, was pretty much, I think, the sustainable aspect to getting the water to people. Because getting clean water to our taps is very energy hungry. And for us to be able to come up with, you know, methods that use less energy, less power, that make the most of gravity and make the most of the water falling, you know, freely on our roofs is what we need to be thinking of for this society as well as the developing world.
No, it's really, really interesting to hear you talk about that and reflect on it. Again, for people who may be tuning in and learning about your career for the first time, as well as your studies and your background, you've also worked for some major organisations in the UK, ARUP being one, and Lang Ruach, the global construction and engineering firm. In terms of the construction and infrastructure projects that you've worked on, are there one or two that have been particularly memorable, either to do with the complexity of the challenge or just some aspect of them that you worked on?
Yes, so three projects come to mind. I feel like the first project I worked on, you know, as that kind of baby engineer, like always have to feature, right? Because literally, you know, like straight out of university, really trying to work out like, you know, what my place was in the world, like obviously very, very scared about, you know, potentially getting things wrong and designing, you know, a system that then fails and like just gets everybody into trouble. Yeah, so I'd say the one of the first ones, which was a school project. It was a really fun school project out in Devon with a big, massive, huge sustainability theme. We created these enlarged cisterns that collected water directly from the roof, so the kids could see the water coming in directly from the roof into their toilet spaces. So there was a big, massive aspect of engagement, of students' engagement in the architecture as well as in the engineering. Another one I really enjoyed working on was out in China. Again, right? Just me in a place, space that was very, very foreign to me, not being able to speak the language, but learning how to communicate with, you know, my colleagues. It was an incredible hotel project with a hotel building and a water park and lots of different rides and dolphin stadiums, the works. Again, big, massive sustainability theme. You know, for me, it was a huge opportunity to learn how to design super high-rise buildings and pretty plush like hotels as well. And more recently, I've had the opportunity to work on a hospital project. And when you work on hospital projects, right, there's that immediate connection because, you know, you're creating a space where people hopefully go into and receive care and become better. And so, yeah, a £500 million project, absolutely worth every second spent in it.
Is it true that you speak a little bit of Mandarin?
Indian, very tiny. Indian means very, very tiny. And that's probably all I can say. Like, the thing is, you move to China and you absolutely need to learn enough Mandarin to be able to tell your taxi driver where you're trying to get to. Otherwise, you're pretty much, you might as well just pack your bag and go back. and order food as well. Yeah, definitely.
We kicked off the interview by talking about the lockdown and coronavirus, and you sort of shared some of your feelings about that. Have your priorities changed in any way, or has your focus sort of sharpened on any sort of aspects of your career? Has it kind of affected your thinking?
My focus has sharpened, and I have become a little bit more courageous in dropping things that I feel I don't necessarily need at the moment. You know, like, as we go through life, there are a lot of things that we pick up as needs, in quote. And actually, when we really think about them, they're more like wants, right? We feel like we need to fit this persona of, oh, you are working a 9-to-5, or you are engaging with certain type of people, or you are saying the right things to the right people. And actually, what I have found whilst I've reflected is you just need to be true to who you are at all times. It sometimes feels like you've got all the time in the world, but actually, you know, what you've got is now, and it's really about making the most and being confident in the fact that you have enough skills to make the most of now, and definitely using all that you have and all that you've gained over the years to get to that place that you can actually bring tangible impact to other people's lives.
Absolutely. And speaking about tangible impact, in terms of other people's lives, science, technology, engineering and maths, or abbreviated to STEM, in terms of the media. What does STEM mean to you, and how important is STEM for girls and young children?
Yes, so STEM to me means the tool that we use to bring creativity, art, purpose to life, right? So we use the physics and the technology and the engineering to take us from that place where we have an idea that would help make people's lives easier, better, you know, bolder, and bring it into its reality. And so when people say, but physics is too difficult, so, and maths is too difficult, I'm like, it's only a tool. It's only part of the bigger picture. It's only part of, you know, the exercise of going from that place of vision to reality. And that's what I always say to young people. You know, they go, oh, I want to change the world. I want to bring something different to the world, but I don't like maths. I'm like, well, actually, you're in a good place, right? Because your starting place needs to be, you want to change the world and you want to make things easier for people, or you want to make the world more sustainable. And that is 60% of the journey. Now, all you have to do is, you know, use as little or as much of the maths and the physics to then get you to that place where you can actually realize your dream. And it's so exciting now because there's this diversification of STEM. Honestly, I just think of like 100 years ago, right? When you were either a civil engineer, you know, Brunel, or, you know, you were, you were either just a civil engineer or a shipbuilder, right? And now there's this incredible spectrum of different things that you can be: a biomedical engineer, you know, a technologist, a sustainability engineer, you know, a construction expert, a scientist. Oh, it's just so exciting. And everything is clearer in its relation back to purpose in society. You can kind of trace it back to its place in society a lot easier than you would have, I don't know, 100 years ago. Yeah, so very exciting.
You mentioned earlier, I think you described it, you were a baby engineer. I wanted to ask you a two-part question. What was the kind of reaction to you when you first started out in your career, when you were arriving on projects, you know, in different cultures, different parts of the world? And also, how important is diversity in engineering?
My baby years were actually like smooth sailing. It was so, so easy because I was there to learn. And when you're there to learn, right, you aren't a threat to anybody because, because you're this sponge, really. And people can just pretty much, you know, like feed you with whatever they think you should be fed with. And to be honest, I had the most incredible mentors. You know, my boss was just absolutely godsend. And so for the first 2-3 years of my career, I was very much shielded, and I was definitely not a threat to anybody. And then I started to grow. The baby started to grow into a toddler. And this toddler was, you know, a lot more vocal in what she thought, you know, in the ideas that she thought, you know, should be implemented on projects. And, you know, things kind of went from, whoa, 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 you know, hang on, right? The baby is talking and she actually has an opinion and she's saying stuff. And I'm not sure if I've got the listening ears, you know, for this toddler. And actually, that's when I, you know, came across like some of my biggest challenges. I had to learn how to communicate in a way that, you know, I could be happy with the output and the outcome. You know, there was a lot of politics as well. I had to learn how to stand up for myself. I had to overcome the feeling of being incompetent as well. That was something I struggled with for a very, very long time. And I had to prove to myself on several occasions that I was there for a reason and I had something to bring to the table. It's an ongoing project, trust me.
I think what you're saying is we're all a work in progress. I think it's great to hear you saying that as well. We've talked about lockdown and I just kind of wondered on a human level, because I ask a lot of guests on Comms to the Shed this question, but what have been your kind of comfort things? What have been your go-to things in lockdown? It could be food, it could be TV, books, music, sport and fitness, but what's been your comfort thing or things that have gotten you through?
Oh, okay. So before lockdown, I didn't watch that much TV. And even though I'd present like TV stuff, but I just, you know, I wouldn't binge on stuff, for example, right? Except, and I think the last time I binged on anything was Prison Break, and that was like how many years ago? Yes, but my husband is a TV watcher, like literally, like he would sacrifice sleep for television. And so, you know, like after we kind of went through the, you know, phase of, okay, right, I'm actually stuck with you, like in this house for days, right? You know, I had to kind of fit myself back into his life because I'd somehow removed myself from it because I'd been so busy. And so we found, you know, we found like programs that we could both watch. My daughter joined us, like, so we'd watch MasterChef. Yeah, MasterChef, yeah, for hours. We'd watch stuff on Netflix as well. There's a glass program called Blown Away, I think, on Netflix. We'd watch, I know, like random stuff, Narcos, whatever, like just lots of different things. That's been actually really nice. That's been very nice. And there was a time I decided I needed to stay fit. It was not long lasting, but yeah, that was fun because I could get my daughter to help and support me and encourage me and shout out, go on, carry on, mommy, carry on, you do it. But dance and music have always been a part of like my everyday, you know, like I need music. I need to be able to move around. So it's been nice to have that as well. Yeah. Not much reading. Definitely not much reading, but yeah. The music, the dance, and the TV, yeah.
You're not alone. Fitness was very much lockdown one. That was so not lockdown one. We were all running up and down the garden. I know I was. And now, not so much. Coffee and croissants all day long now. I must ask you to bring it back to where it all began. What are your hopes for the future in terms of improving infrastructure in different parts of the world? I know, obviously, in Nigeria and Africa, it's a particular passion project because of where you grew up. But what would your hopes be in this kind of short and maybe longer term?
I think we've spent the last 100, 150 years making a lot of things too complex for our world. And we've built up this sense of complexity and, you know, found ways to make very, very, what would be very, very simple interventions seem so difficult and expensive and, you know, nearly impossible because we want to make a case for grants, for GDP, for, you know, flow of cash and loans and whatever. My hope for the world is that we can throw a lot of the jargon out and simplify it all and have conversations around delivering sustainable infrastructure that does not cost an arm and a leg and jargon and political complexity, and really just make the most of the resources in terms of talent, in terms of technology, to make people's lives better.
Having worked at Langaroa, I've seen the changes that have been happening in the construction industry in recent years. Now, you're someone who's come through the education system to study engineering, but both you would have seen, as I did, that increasingly there are more women coming into construction and infrastructure. What would your message be to any women that were considering it as a career or considering a career change to move into that sector?
I'd say the construction industry needs you. That's where I would start from, because we need the diversity of thinking that you definitely will bring, right? You know, the other thing I would say is, you know, when you come in, right, yes, it's difficult. And I'm not even going to be shy about that or, you know, like suggest that it's easy or it's not difficult. It is difficult. It is what it is because it hasn't had the opportunity, you know, experience the change that diversity will have on the industry. And that has to happen. That has to happen. You know, that has to happen for the industry to survive. When we think of how technology has impacted our world and the new and emerging industries that have kind of come about because of this new way of thinking, I get worried for the construction industry because it only takes for somebody to come up with a different, super cost-effective way of doing one thing is a big, massive game changer. And so for it to survive, it needs to innovate. It needs to be relevant. And so, you know, anybody who's thinking of innovating, women see things in color, right? There is definitely a place in the construction industry. Absolutely.
Just to finish off, I want to ask you a couple of questions going back to your youth, because I was thinking about the fact that you are a mentor to various people, and obviously you've had very inspirational mentors yourself. I would imagine your mum, as you mentioned, who was for long periods a single parent, was a fantastic and very inspirational mentor. And you also mentioned, I believe, and I forget where you said it, that you mentioned that you really miss the food in Nigeria. And I just wondered if you could share a memory of one of your mum's signature dishes. What kind of things would your mum cook you? What are your favourite meals that you remember as a girl in Nigeria?
Oh, wow. Okay, so my mom... my mom... Honestly, I look back on some of the stuff that my mom made for us as kids, and I just kind of think, Mom, what on earth were you trying to do to us? Do you know what? Now I sit her down and I say, Mommy, taste this. This is how jollof rice is supposed to taste, right? Not just rice with lots of like scotch bonnet and like no tomatoes in it, right? You know what I mean? My mom is really into spicy food. And there are times that, you know, literally I'd be eating and crying at the same time just because the food was so hot and spicy. And she was always trying to convince us. And that's exactly how we should have tasted. But now I know, I'm a lot wiser. And so there's this really funny thing that, you know, we do all the time where I kind of cook a dish from my childhood and just say, hey, Mom, taste it. Like, yeah, do you prefer mine? And she's like, yes, maybe. But yeah, she used to make lots of jollof rice, which is, you know, West African, delicacy, right? You know, you go to parties and there's always jollof rice. You know, it's rice with tomato and, you know, peppers and, you know, curry powder and thyme spices and lots of different things and onions. And she used to make lots of that. She used to make a lot of things in the pressure cooker as well.
Some lovely memories. And just to finish off, bringing you full circle to your own family. And you have one daughter, is that right?
Yes, I do. Yes.
What sort of life lessons are you passing on to your own daughter? What are your kind of hopes and aspirations? And has she expressed an interest in anything related to the kind of career you've had?
Oh, do you know what? I'm learning so much from her right now. And honestly, I think her generation is completely different to mine. You know, like there was a lot of, okay, you're the child, you know, your parent is the parent type relationships when I was growing up. And now I'm looking to her for inspiration. I love the fact that she's so curious, always asking questions. She's a bit of a... the word is not drama queen. She would tell you she's not a drama queen. She's a drama princess, but she's very confident. You know, she's very, very confident in that you can't give her a half-baked answer to her question. You know, if she goes, how is this building built? You have to give her the full story. She's very interested in buildings. She watches Grand Designs nonstop. She just turned 4. She sees me come up on TV and gets so excited at the fact that she can see Mommy building something. She says, I want to become an engineer so I can travel the world with you and always be with you. And that is amazing. But she also wants to become a fashion designer. She also wants to become a hairdresser. She also wants to become an artist, and she also wants to become a chef. So right now I'm saying, girl, you can be anything and as many things, you know, as possible. And I'm just, yeah, just enjoying the flourishing and the unfolding pretty much, yeah.
Well, it feels to me like that's brought our story pretty much full circle. It's been a tremendous pleasure talking to you today, Ioande, and I look forward to sharing this episode of Comms from the Shed. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a wonderful pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of Comms from the Shed. Hit subscribe if you want to know when new episodes are available, or check out our Instagram page for the latest updates.